Hello, welcome to Under Another Name. Today we're going to be talking about two things. First of all, again, there have been protests across the country. And in London, there was the bizarre event of police officers, about 10 or between 10 and 20 of them, surrounding the Churchill statue. So I thought we'd talk about that this week to start things off, because it seems to me that the disproportionate police presence around a statue is quite relevant in trying to understand what's going on in the wider culture war that we seem to be in the middle of. And then I want to then talk a little bit about socialism. And this was prompted really by a short conversation I had on Twitter and a blog that I've just written. And essentially what I think is that people misunderstand what socialism is, or at least they've got quite a narrow definition of what they think socialism is based upon what socialism was in the 20th century. And I thought that'd be worth exploring. But let's start with the Churchill statue. Well, what does it reveal about the state of our politics that we have police officers guarding a statue of Winston Churchill?
Is that a question for me, James?
Yeah, I think so. I think I'll let you start us on that.
Okay, so what does it say about our politics? It says that our politics is very much concerned with the way, you know, a kind of... making things... It's all about what things, essentially, what they look like and signifying certain key messages to, core political audiences that you're trying to target, as opposed to, you know, I think I would say, yeah, genuinely trying to solve actual problems. I think our government is mainly focused on ensuring that its core supporters are kept in a state of kind of perpetual rage, I think, and that's achieved by both signifying to them that there are people who threaten the things they hold dear, and that then they, as you know, in kind of alliance with the forces of the state, the police, are the bastions against that, so that you can stop these nasty people from taking away these things you value by putting all of your trust in us. And that, you know, that's a very effective message. And so, you know, yes, I thought it was, you know, it was pretty sort of like, there's a level on which it's all a bit craven and embarrassing that they do stuff like that, because it's so obvious that, you know, there was no threat to that statue. And even if there was, you don't need 15 police officers like permanently standing around it. And in fact, I suspect those police officers probably weren't permanently standing around it. They were just, you know, they were just there long enough for it to register that they were there. And I put it therefore in the same bracket as there was a story over the weekend about the National Trust, and that there was a new kind of coalition of members within the National Trust who were getting together to oppose this like new woke culture, which was, you know, talking about slavery and the empire, and this was really evil and wrong. And, you know, it transpires this is literally about 300 members of the National Trust, which is an organization that I think has, I'm right in saying, has several million members. 300 members had basically got together and had formed this group to oppose this direction of travel, which of course is essentially just an organization committed to like public history and memory, recording relevant information about the buildings that it safeguards. Like, it's just like literally the job of the National Trust to do stuff like this. But again, it doesn't matter. Like, no one's judging this on the basis of like who's got the best arguments. It's just groups like this are really helpful signifiers of who's on your side if you feel like your history and your culture are under threat. And so, you know, this tiny little group, you know, on an issue where the public overall, if just to take the National Trust example, like 70-75% of the public think the National Trust is doing the right thing, basically, but the Telegraph and the Times will still put this new organization, you know, I think I'm writing saying Telegraph on the front page, and also like have comment articles about it, because this is so central to their politics, far more than any economic program or, you know, political agenda. Well, yeah, no, you know, any substantial political agenda. This world of flags and symbolism is at the center of what these guys are about.
Right. So let's just unpack that a little bit. We've got, from our perspective at least, an imaginary threat, right? It doesn't exist in reality. There's a whole discourse that's developed that's partly manufactured by a right-wing media that really exists to create and amplify these imaginary threats in order to create a moral panic around certain issues that's going to allow commentators to whip up a sort of a culture war type story on social media that's going to really engage a certain portion of the electorate. And that's critical, because the nature of first past the post is that you don't need to win a majority of people over to your cause. What you need to do is to capture a certain portion of the electorate. You need to keep together a fragile coalition of voters in order to give you around about 40% of the vote. And that's going to be enough to deliver you a majority in the House of Commons. And so from our perspective, what Boris Johnson is quite cleverly doing is stocking up or leaning into these culture war issues that are stocked up by outriders on the right in order that he can keep his electoral base really motivated to vote Conservative, because the Labour Party is associated with people like us, people who believe that people essentially believe in whatever you would describe as woke. And, you know, let's be clear about what that means. It means that we believe that we want to live in a society that restructures power in order that those people who've been marginalized in our society are given power and status that they haven't historically have, or that they've been historically deprived.
Yeah, and can I just comment on that, James, briefly? Like, woke, I mean, it doesn't even really mean that, does it? It just means you're alive to those issues. You know, literally just being woke is just, you're aware of the fact that there are these inequalities of power. There are these historical issues that have fundamentally shaped the world we live in now. And you're just aware of that. And
actually, quite sure, but
it's a really weird thing to be against, right?
Awareness means that you're going to do something about it, right? I mean, if you're aware
for sure.
Yes, that's the point I'm making, that you're not just going to be aware of something. And then, I mean, maybe for a lot of people, they would do that. And actually, the charge that's leveled by the right is that what we're doing by highlighting these issues is that we're just virtue signaling. So there's a sort of emptiness that they ascribe to those of us that believe in. I shouldn't take on board this language, right? I don't want to take on board this language, but they're throwing it at me. Really, and part of me wants to say, well, yes, I am. I do believe in the woke ideology, as you frame it, because I believe that we live in a society where power, wealth, opportunity, status has been squirreled away by a tiny minority. And essentially what you're saying to us is that when the 99% of us that have been oppressed historically, and I'm talking about the working class, I'm talking about gay people, I'm talking about black people, ethnic minorities, women, when we say, actually, we're going to question that power using what little power is afforded to us by the emergence of social media, well, all of a sudden we're silencing you. Not, it's the language that's used as well. So I wrote about this in a blog recently. The language is always, we're always a mob. And the language of the mob is always used historically to denigrate those that question power. It was used by the British when the American revolutionaries started to campaign against the power of the king. It was used against the Chartists by the parliamentarians in the British Parliament. The language of the mob is always used to conjure up this idea of a sort of unthinking rabble that want to impose their view on others. And the reality is, in politics, that never happens. It's not possible for it to happen because, as Locke points out in one of his great treatises, A Letter Concerning Toleration, and he's talking about something very different, but his fundamental point is you can't impose belief. The only way that you can impose belief. Yeah. The only way that you can change someone's mind is by arguing with them. And that's all we're trying to do. I can't silence Piers Morgan. And I'd like to be able to say that if it was in my power, I wouldn't, but actually I bloody would. This is very annoying.
Absolutely. I mean, it's really interesting, isn't it? How the common charge, I was just going to say, I think these terms like virtue signaling are really important to talk about and to highlight, because virtue signaling is really revealing. It's sort of like in it, it contains this acknowledgement that you're basically arguing for stuff that is, fundamentally, morally quite strong and actually like quite hard to contest. But so then there's this internal, within that phrase, there's this denigration of like, but this is just like, this is just signaling, this is just positioning. Now, that's really interesting. That's indicative of people who can only really see politics as a game of positioning. They can't really understand it in any other way. So they just assume that if you're taking these principles that are morally virtuous, it must just be because, or seem to be morally virtuous, it must just be because you want to get more Facebook friends or social media likes or whatever. You know, it's kind of inconceivable to them that you would actually do this because you genuinely believe that it was the right thing and you saw history in a particular way, you saw structures of power in a particular way. And the beauty of the term virtue signaling is you never have to engage with any of that. You just like immediately like, you're just a hypocrite. You know, I don't have to really take seriously anything you say. And that's, so you're starting from that position. And I think the charge of hypocrisy is just really interesting. If you're thinking about kind of like modern politics, the way politics works on the left and the right, the charge of hypocrisy is one that constantly gets leveled at the left. Why is that? Because basically the left actually believe in stuff. They have a set of like genuine core principles that they are seeking to advance. Essentially, it reveals that basically everybody else, I know this might sound a slightly extreme statement, but I think there's a lot of truth in it. Everybody else essentially just sees politics as a game, as a kind of vehicle for, embedding certain structures of power and maintaining them, and then also just like furthering their own personal careers and so on, and
it's an inversion in other senses, isn't it? I mean, so if the charge is that the woke mob is attempting to silence critics by imposing a particularly narrow conception of identity politics, something like that, the reality is that if you look at what's really going on in our society, it's left-wing voices that are denigrated. It's ethnic minority voices that are attacked. If you go back to the 2017 election and you look at online abuse directed at members of parliament, over 50% of the online abuse that was recorded was directed at one member of parliament, Diane Abbott, one of the first black members of parliament, and on the left. And that's not surprising, because that's what you would expect. Given the fact that in actual fact, our media environment is such that far from being silenced, right-wing voices constantly get a platform in our media. And I would argue that, and I've said, I think I said this last week, as soon as you move to the left in politics, you're kind of automatically discredited in the minds of most people. You're hard left, you're beyond the pale, you're radical, and therefore your voice is not worth listening to. And, so what's particularly frustrating about this narrative is that, it's gaslighting. The opposite is true. It is not right-wing voices that are being silenced. In fact, we're surrounded by its cacophonous. Darren Grimes is trending on Twitter as we speak. The vapid non-entity that is Darren Grimes.
Yeah, I think just to build on what you're saying, in terms of that inversion, often the charge that's made against the sort of woke left is it's hysterical. It's like it's an angry mob. It's kind of like hunting down people who disagree with them. You know, these are descriptions that exactly, they encapsulate the approach of the kind of angry white right wing anti woke kind of crusades, where you see, for example, a conservative MP suggested, what was it that, I can't remember, was it people who denigrated the flag should be imprisoned? I think I saw that quite recently online. The hysteria around
It wasn't quite that. It was that teachers who question the flying of flags in schools should be
sacked.
Educated.
Then re-educated, yeah.
There's a sort of idea of maybe teachers sitting around in some sort of like Tory education camp. learning about the flag and what it represents.
Well, I mean, yeah, but I mean, we.
I quite enjoyed that, to be honest.
Well, this is. I mean, we shouldn't forget. Like, this has been. This is actual political reality that has existed in European countries in the last 50 to 100 years. I mean, this does happen. So, you know, when you're thinking about hysteria, you know, people like Piers Morgan crying about getting cancelled because they're held to account for things they say. I think that's crucial to understand, right? Again, like let's go back to Winston Churchill for a moment. Why would people go and graffiti Winston Churchill statue? It's just because they hate British values and they you know, they just like kind of like virtue signaling about how woke they are about the knowledge of the empire. No, it's because Winston Churchill was definitely a racist. I'm you know, let's be quite unequivocal about that. Doesn't mean you can't celebrate his role in the Second World War. There are good reasons to do that because Britain did stand alone against fascism between 1939 and 1940. But Churchill's absolutely held hugely offensive racist ideas. And in certain cases, as Prime Minister, those ideas shaped horrible, destructive policies around, particularly the Bengal famine, which had terrible human consequences. So on that issue, there's this sort of sense of like, you're not allowed to feel all those things, or you're not allowed to hold Winston Churchill as an historical figure to account. You're not allowed to hold Piers Morgan to account. Why not? Because this is the group of people that we, as a kind of like a collective set of media gatekeepers, have decided are okay. Like, they're either one of us or they're one of the political figures who is, you know, we revere, and that's it. You're not, there's no further discussion allowed. Again, same could be said about national trust houses. And this also takes me back to a conversation I had just when I was really starting to become aware of myself as somebody who was actually on the left, you know, and becoming more conscious of that. I got into an argument quite unexpectedly about Amber Rudd, because I read this story that Amber Rudd had been disinvited to an event at a student union. I can't remember any more than that. And someone was like, typical woke students like canceling Amber Rudd. And it was just, I just sort of suddenly thought, hang on a second. It's totally up to an individual university society if they want to invite someone, and then if they want to disinvite them. There's no free speech issue there. It's like, I don't have a platform at that university. I'm just going to talk there. And actually, you know, two things came into my mind. One, is Amber Rudd politically silenced? No. She probably she'd been interviewed quite recently on the Today program when I was talking about it. She's got a pretty quite strong political platform, even though she's no longer an MP. And also, are there things that Amber Rudd should be held to account for that mean that maybe it's questionable to give her a kind of uncritical platform? Absolutely, yes. Some of the things she did as Home Secretary were morally abhorrent. And she absolutely should be held to account for those things. And you could invite her and you could ask her those questions. But actually, you know what? Why should these people always get invited along? Why not actually, instead of that, have somebody who was a member of the Windrush generation, who was actually a victim of the policies that Amber Rudd enforced, and actually let them give their perspective? You know, why do we have this view that there's a particular set of politicians who are basically regarded as like fundamentally acting in good faith, and maybe they make the odd mistake, but you know, can't hold that against them. Let's let them kind of come and talk about it as often as they like. Whereas, Diane Abbott, Jeremy Corbyn, you know, absolutely kind of still regarded as beyond the pale.
Yeah, so there's a philosopher called Jürgen Habermas, and he's not talking about this debate. He's actually talking about postmodernism. He's got this idea called the performance contradiction. And the idea is that in saying something, you sort of logically sweep the rug from under your own feet. So an example of this is Piers Morgan writing in the Daily Mail, complaining about being silenced. It's a performance contradiction. If you were being silenced, you wouldn't have a column in the Daily Mail to complain about being silenced. And this happens all of the time, and it is maddening. I used to subscribe to the Times newspaper, and when you cancel your subscription, they ask you, why are you cancelling? And I said, I'm sick to death of every other day having to read a column from one of your columnists about being silenced or about cancel culture, because it's just not true. Otherwise, I wouldn't be subjected to it every day reading the Times. And going back to the statue, the irony of people objecting to a particular form of protest in terms of spray painting a statue is that if we think about this in the context of empire, the whole way that Britain maintained an empire was by brutally suppressing forms of action and forms of protest of exactly this kind. If people didn't engage in direct action, if people didn't engage in violent confrontation, if people didn't risk their lives to get rid of a brutally repressive empire, then we'd still be there, because that's the reason we left, because it became expensive to run an empire where there was opposition considerably more violent than spray painting a statue. So I can't help but see the irony of objecting to a little bit of spray paint on a statue of somebody who was, I mean, you know, leaving aside the racism thing, one of the things that anybody can agree with about Winston Churchill is he was madly keen on the empire. It defined him in politics, that he was somebody that thought the British Empire was great and should be maintained. And the reason his history that he writes of this country is not called History of Britain, it's called A History of the English-Speaking Peoples, because he had this idea of a kind of white man's empire that he thought was a sort of model of what Britain should be.
Churchill has all kinds of like coded ways of talking about, you know, the superiority of white people. You know, he talks a lot about the Anglo-Saxon race, the English-speaking peoples. Yeah, you know, that's the kind of terminology that he's just steeped in, and he was absolutely denigrated. People like Mahatma Gandhi and others who led these kind of independence movements, these nationalist movements that were seeking to overthrow British imperial power, you know, he had total contempt for them. Now, personally, I mean, this is another conversation, but I don't particularly like judge Churchill really, really harshly for that, because I also just think that's just like, that's very much, he's definitely a product of his time. You know, I've studied a lot of
even someone like Clement history and said very, very racist things, right? So
yeah, quite. Yeah. No, exactly. So in that sense, do people have a right to say, here is a man that we heroise, here is a man that we lionize. There are some things that are troubling about him. Do people have a right to raise that in the public sphere? Absolutely they do. Just as they have a right to highlight and talk about the legacy of British history, which Churchill in so many ways kind of embodies. Who gets silenced? Yeah, very often, exactly the people who are engaged in that. Very often it is those like poor old National Trust researchers who are just trying to sort of like, you know, expand our knowledge about like 17th century country houses, you know, are treated like kind of like marauding psychopaths who are trying to destroy Britishness and you know, sink us into the ground. There are plenty of people like that. You know, it's much, much easier for somebody to get on, I don't know, Good Morning TV or whatever, if they're complaining about the woke mob than someone who's sort of taking apart these ideas and advocating for a more nuanced and wide-ranging appraisal of British history. It's really, really difficult to get your voice, get public attention for that on LBC or whatever. So yeah, the hypocrisy is really just runs like a stick of rock or whatever, like right through the heart of this form of politics. And it's really cynical. You know, the people engaged in it, you know, at some level they all know what they're doing, and they just don't care, because the benefits of doing it are obvious. In fact, there's no, you know, the Conservative Party cannot win unless it engages in those kinds of tactics. And they really hate the people that they're sort of, and the reason they hate them is because they're kind of people who are, you know, who are woke, are literally the people who are sort of, you know, trying to say, no, sorry, you need to pay attention to this. You can't just look away and pretend it's not there. Well, you know, people who want to stay asleep, and, you know, they really hate those people. So, you know, for me, it's, I just see it as like a badge of honor. People like that are getting cross. And
but at the same time, you know, they're prodding at something that is a genuine sort of problem for the left that has always been there. So if you think about the sorts of issues that have caused schisms within the Labour Party throughout its history, it was, for example, whether we should be involved in World War One, and if we're involved, whether we should be encouraging or opposing conscription. There were huge debates again around World War Two, further along about whether Northern Ireland was an example of British colonialism and what position Labour MPs should take on the struggles. So this sort of engagement with empire and engagement with how we understand our national identity and our place in the world has always created schisms in the left, and they're just prodding at that a little bit, aren't they? Well, not a little bit, a
yeah,
lot.
The left should realise that the game is stacked against them, and so don't bother playing a game that's stacked against you. You know, the Labour, you know, people who are on the left should stand up for the principles that, get them into politics and that they believe in. And I think they should just, we just need to, and I think this is going to take us on nicely to our next topic, actually, but they need to ignore, people on the left just need to ignore people like Matthew Goodwin, who have this ludicrous kind of conceptualization of a left which is basically stripped of all of its kind of internationalist solidarity, and is essentially just a sort of inward looking very narrow nationalistic form of, like, you know, with actually quite basic like economic tinkering to win over, you know, sort of socially conservative voters. It's just a complete dead end. And so, you know, as we've said a lot about this, you know, I think we can push on from here. But yeah, it's strategically a dead end. It's morally bankrupt.
Well, let's push on then.
So
the second topic I wanted to discuss is, what is socialism? And the reason I wanted to talk about this is that I think if you will ask a lot of people to sort of, and I'd encourage people watching or listening to do the same, if I mention the word socialism, what comes into your head? Now, I'd imagine for a lot of our listeners, it'll be something quite different. But I think for most people, I think if you ask somebody to imagine the word socialism and to conjure up some images, they'd probably think of the USSR. They'd probably think of Lenin and Stalin, maybe Mao. So they'd think of, it's got a variety of different names, Leninism, Stalinism, Maoism. And they'd also maybe think of European social democracy. So in Britain, they might think, Clement Attlee and what he did, that's what I mean by socialism. So they'd sort of appeal to a social democratic tradition of socialism. Do you think that's right? Is that what you would have thought if I'd said to you 5 years ago, what do you think of when you think of socialism? Would these have been the images that you would have been conjured up?
Yeah, I think if I'm honest, I would probably have just thought of the word defeat. I think my whole politics was animated by the idea that socialism was a set of political ideas that had lost, and that there wasn't really much more to be said about it, actually. That maybe I would have to some extent connected the Labour Party of 1945 with socialism, but I would have said, like, yeah, the Labour Party is basically a means of taking some socialist ideas and then making them palatable in a society that is capitalist. Capitalism is, as an economic system, is just one. It's just superior by definition. And, you know, there are people out there who haven't worked that out yet, but, you know, tough. You know, history has delivered, you know, its verdict. And I guess so. That was, you know, I was still someone who essentially...
Well, that's an interesting way of putting it, because I think that's how a lot of people feel about socialism still.
Yeah.
You know, essentially the view of a lot of people would be, and I think this maybe explains a little bit of why older voters are less likely to look favourably on the Labour Party, because they belong to a generation that that sort of buys into this narrative. But actually, as a teacher, I see it all the time with young people too. It's partly a problem with history teachers, I think, actually, because I think that history teachers teach socialism very, very badly. And partly that's excusable because...
This is a dig at me, listeners, by
it's
the
not
way.
A dig at, no, it's not a dig at you, it's a dig at history teachers. I know you are a history teacher.
Part of the issue
is if you're teaching a lesson on socialism, it's likely to come up in the context of World War II, right? And it's likely to come up in the context of, or it's likely to come in the, up in the context of the Cold War. And so you're going to say, well, socialism is what was going on in the USSR. And in Britain, we had socialism because we had a post-war Labour government. And the analysis is not going to go much further than that. And for a lot of people, the economic problems of the 1970s, by which I mean that the trade unions were going on strike an awful lot, that inflation was rampant, that we had low economic growth and high unemployment. So we had what's called stagflation, largely because of the Yom Kippur War and the response of the OPEC countries, which was to reduce the oil supply in the Middle East, which caused inflationary pressure. But there we are. Lots of people would say, well, Clement Attlee's Butzke-like consensus, the post-war consensus, was smashed in the 1970s and discredited. And then Thatcherism, well, that worked out pretty well because privatization, deregulation, all that sort of stuff helped Britain. Lots of people would think that. And the end of the Cold War and what we saw of those societies, which was that essentially, you know, state socialism as represented by the USSR entailed totalitarianism, it entailed secret police, gulags, etc., and economic ruin, actually, for in a lot of cases. Well, that discredited other forms of socialism. So I think that's what a lot of people think. And the problem with that analysis is that, for me anyway, is that both forms of socialism that I've mentioned, social democracy and the socialism practice in the USSR, what you might call state socialism, are statist forms of socialism. So both forms of socialism essentially say that socialism is about moving power to the state and then the state doing something in order to create a more egalitarian society. And I just don't think that's what socialism should be about. I think socialism needs to be about, and actually I think Marxist socialism has always been about this, it's about moving ownership, power and control of industry narrowly, but maybe power more broadly to the workers. And it's that tradition of socialism that I support. I don't really have a question. You're just nodding away there.
No, I am. This is really interesting. I think what is in my head as I'm listening to you talk is something like the Paris Commune of 1871, which is a radical socialist takeover of Paris, which occurs at the time of the Franco-Prussian War. France is on the brink of defeat. And this group of left-wing radicals seize control of the city. They act in a kind of the very name, the Paris Commune, has this resonance in like French revolutionary history. But this is a very much more radical realization of that concept. And it kind of builds on, there have been like echoes of socialist ideas in like 1848, like less so, to be honest, in the revolution of 89 to 93. And I think there's something about 1871, which feels like it's this, okay, we're finally almost realizing what all of that was about. And what's amazing, and it's really worth been, because we are in the 150th anniversary of the Paris Commune. There's some really good stuff that's available online to go and read or listen to on its history. And it's just a really, really fascinating political moment. And the thing that's fascinating about it, there's lots of like bloody violence, particularly in the suppression of the Paris Commune, which you can read about. But what's really interesting is all the ideas. So for me, like, what do I think of as socialism? I think it's like people getting together to solve problems, to construct environments, communities where they are empowered, where they're in control of their own lives, issues that in the workplace, in communities, are dealt with by that community of people through collective discussion the power is vested within those groups of people. But I think it's also about having a radical perspective on the world where you don't view politics as a sort of a certain set of agreed things which you're allowed to do, and then a whole load of stuff that's just off limits. There's a real kind of utopian element to socialism, which is really important because socialism gives you the power to reimagine what society might look like, what communities can accomplish. To me, a truly socialist society would be one in which the public good is kind of regarded as the highest ideal, and you don't have a situation where it's possible for private individuals to accumulate vast quantities of wealth through the labor of others. Like, that's just not possible, because the produce, the labor of society is then collectively enjoyed by
it's interesting you talk about accumulation, because of course that's what one of the, obviously, sorry, I'm being very incoherent, but where socialism develops from is this idea that capitalism leads to unequal concentrations of wealth, and of course that's true. But what's maybe worth mentioning in the context of Britain is that whereas the French had a revolution and to some extent overthrew the feudal system, Britain never did that. So in a sense, we have the problems created by capitalism. We have capitalist accumulation, but we also have the problems of feudalism, because the accumulation that occurred during the time of feudalism haven't gone away. So I think something like 30% of the land in the UK is still owned by the aristocracy, for example. The other thing that what you were saying made me think of, because when I asked you initially, what does socialism mean to you? You said failure. And I think that's interesting, because I think what happens, I've been reading a book about the history of the Labour parties, I've sort of been noticing a trend, which is that the forces of the left push for radical change. And essentially, the argument is always the same. The argument, if we go back to the first Labour government, led by Ramsay MacDonald, there was an argument within the Labour Party which went something like this. They didn't have a majority, right? So it was a minority government. They weren't going to be able to get anything done. And the left of the party said, well, okay, fine. Let's just put some ideas forward in legislation that we know will fail, and then people will see what we're trying to achieve. And when we've done that, they'll know what we're about, and they'll be more inclined to vote for us because actually we've put forward these radical measures. The right of the party goes, we're not convinced about that, because that makes us look like that a Labour government equals failure. So why don't we just put through some measures that we know the Tories will support us on? So we'll do that. And that's what ends up happening, okay? And essentially the history of the Labour Party is these two forces playing out. The left saying, let's be bold and make a sort of an offer to the people. And then the right of the party saying, oh, let's be less radical because that'll make us look too extreme and people won't vote for it. And that's a simplification, right? But it is what happens, and it happens to Attlee too, right? So think about something like nationalisation. The point of nationalisation for somebody on the left is that the state takes control of industry first, and then there's a further process of change. The state controlling industries is not inherently socialist, because in order for it to become socialist, you need to do something with that ownership. So you either need to democratize the workplace or genuinely give control to workers by actually transferring ownership of the company to the workers or whatever. But what did Attlee do? He just, well, first of all, he paid the capitalists a lot of money, right? So the companies were overvalued. Secondly, the industries that were nationalized were the worst performing industries in the country. And so essentially, many people have argued that what he ends up doing is shoring up capitalism by taking on the industries that are the sort of least profitable and least valuable. He leaves in place the existing management structure and the existing social relationships within that structure, so that the trade unions maintain their power. And at the time, the trade unions are quite a conservative force, actually, in the labour movement. And so, you know, it's a classic example of the left saying, well, let's do something radical, and the right just not doing it. And then nationalisation becomes this totemic sort of weight around socialism forever, because Mrs. Thatcher can come along in the 80s and say, well, nationalisation was a disaster. But it was a disaster because it was never really done as it was supposed to be done, because nationalisation, a bit like reforming the House of Lords, nationalisation was the first step. What was supposed to happen then was a genuine transformation of ownership, power and control.
Yeah, so I think the thing that occurs to me listening to you there is if we're looking for the tradition of the kind of, let's say, the Labour right, or the, you know, I quite like this phrase, anti-socialist, you know, the group within the Labour Party who's sort of actively always trying to defeat socialism and in some ways see that as their primary function. And obviously there's quite a lot of people who are kind of currently getting a lot of airtime who fall into that camp. What's really interesting to me is these are people who never even fight the battle in the first place. Mm. You know, they sort of, they have these arguments and they say, oh, we can't possibly argue for this or that because, you know, the voters won't wear it or whatever. But they never, you know, they never even, that's never tested. It's just sort of like a given that you can't possibly do any of these things. And I think that's where the 2017 election was just really interesting, because I wouldn't personally say that 2017 Labour manifesto was a truly socialist manifesto. It certainly feels much more, a lot, you know, something like social democracy, you know, is kind of promised within, yeah, what Labour are offering in 2017. But I don't think it's that true process of really shifting power away from Westminster into the hands of people and communities in the way that we've described. But even that, which is this quite modest set of proposals, is still regarded as like laughably beyond the pale. And what's really interesting, I don't want to get too much into politics, even contemporary politics here, but they're so sure that it will bomb that they don't actually really bother to do a proper sabotage job on the Labour Party in 2017. There's almost this like, oh, we'll just, you know, look at the 1983 election. We'll just watch this fall apart. There's almost like, we'll just sit back and watch it implode. And it, you know, it's really interesting to see how it kind of, these simple ideas that have been kept out of the public sphere for such a long time, just people just like, oh, that sounds like a good idea. Yeah, I'll get on board with that. So that's interesting to me is we've got to the point in our discourse where it's not like socialist politics is ever really tested at the ballot box. For me, there's a whole, you know, if you're thinking about how do you transition to a country that could become have put genuine socialist ideas at its heart, you would have to start by democratizing the media so that you have a media space that is not dominated by a wealthy elite who you know set the agenda across the vast majority of the media that's consumed in this country. You'd also have to have a serious attack on the way in which the landed privileged elite continue to hold on to power through the House of Lords, through positions within the judiciary and the kind of wealthy elite who would dominate the civil service, etc., who you know, the aristocracy continue to have vast land ownership. There are all kinds of things that really make, as I say, even like mild social democracy, just people just recoil in horror. And it's sort of like, I also just think, just to, you know, circle back, I was talking about the idea of socialism being equated with defeat in my mind. And part of that was a real complacency in terms of like, seeing that there'd been this great achievement in Britain, basically, that we'd avoided socialist revolution. We had this kind of like modest, like moderate path to achieving a much more equal and fair society. And I just really wasn't alive. And I wasn't, you know, I really blame myself for this, you know, because I was sort of doing reasonably well, you know, at the time, for example, when austerity measures were kicking in. I was you know, I'm quite happy to say I was really blind to, you know, can you seriously look at the UK and say the vast majority of the population feel empowered in their workplaces, in their communities? They feel any sense of like optimism or that their voice counts in any way? Of course you can't. The idea is ridiculous. And this, by the way, and I'll go back to you, James, but I just to circle back again, this takes us back to woke, doesn't it? Because why do you need this whole like endless focus on the woke agenda? Because it's really all you've got in order to speak to people who feel this sense of disempowerment. You can't offer them anything because that would require real structural change. So you just say, oh, yeah, no, the reason you feel like that is because of these people who hate the flag.
Yeah, I mean, no, I think the role of the media is central, isn't it? Because they set the boundaries of the discourse. And so if you look at the history of the Labour Party, what you have is, you know, gradual movement, retreat, 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 until, you know, the maddening thing in the present moment is the Labour Party just don't seem to stand for anything. And the reason for that is the same reason that it's always been, which is that they're terrified, they're utterly terrified, they always have been, of alienating, or the right of the party I'm talking about. They're terrified of alienating the press. They're terrified of alienating the people. And it's really, really instructive to go back to the early days of the Labour Party and to watch that playing out at every single stage of Labour's journey. You've got these two forces pulling against each other, and the sensibles always say, you can't try socialism because it'll put people off. And yet, what you're left with, if you don't have a politics that's about genuine choice, because I don't think we've got genuine choice in politics really at the moment, is a completely hollowed out politics where you've got two parties, and I know you said this in the first episode, you've got two parties that saying roughly the same thing. And if you have a politics that's to the left of that, or even if you've got a politics to the right of that, actually, although the Conservative Party's got a significant right-wing fringe at the moment, so it's happening less, your politics have to be pushed outside of mainstream politics or into smaller parties. And so it's no surprise, therefore, coming back to what we spoke about last week, it's no surprise that you've got the emergence of new parties like the NIP and like the Breakthrough Party, because there's a real space opening up in our politics. And I think what's different about now compared to previous times where the left have, you know, because they've always been left-wing alternatives to Labour, again, throughout the history, the left have periodically left the Labour Party, rejoined, left the Labour Party, rejoined. But what maybe what's different about now, it's got some resonance maybe with the 60s and 70s with the emergence of the New Left, which was a very young movement, is that, but I think more so than that, this is a movement that is, it's quite concentrated in terms of the demographics of age, as we've talked about before. I was going to say something else, but I totally forgot what I was going to say.
Can I jump in on that and you can like rack your brains? Yeah. We're doing this again, like in the evening, you know, we're both, yeah, the mental faculties are failing. But I listened to what you said about the younger generation. I think it's just worth repeating the point that we've made before, because obviously we're also just endlessly repeating ourselves, is to talk about what is it that makes this moment different. Well, it's the marrying of the kind of the economic circumstances of young people, which basically make socialism really, really appealing, with actually the wider concerns that young people have about structural unfairness in our society, whether that's racism, anti-LGBTQ prejudice, anti-traveller prejudice. You know, these are things that actually young people get really animated about, and also climate change, etc. So there's a real marrying of like these two things And I just think, you know, there's, you know, in the end, there's just no way that that Starmer-ish politics are just remotely appealing to this generation. It's just not even, you know, it's miles away from where they are. So
I've remembered what I was going to say, and it's quite important. Yeah. Otherwise, I wouldn't be saying it. The other issue is that the present moment is a moment characterized by crisis. And we've mentioned this before as a political opportunity, but it's also a signal that the status quo isn't working. So if you think about just a few things, capitalism, as we know it, is sort of premised upon the idea that we can continue to grow endlessly. And it only really works if that's the case. The only way that you can continue to provide opportunities, full employment, expanding living standards and the sorts of things that we've grown used to is if you endlessly grow. Now, that is not compatible with solving the climate crisis. Now, we need to come to terms with that. So it's also just not compatible with any understanding of economics. If you go back to over 100 years now to John Stuart Mill's Principles of Political Economy, he talks about the path of growth that he thinks will happen, and he talks about a steady state economy. So what he essentially says is we can't grow forever. We're going to reach a point where we're going to reach a steady state. Growth is going to flatten off. Now that has to happen in order to solve the environmental problem, but it's also probably something which would happen anyway at a certain point because there are natural constraints on economic growth. And, you know, we seem to just want to ignore that fact and to think that we can grow endlessly. And so that reality, that the model of capitalism that is premised on the idea of endless growth, the reality that that isn't sustainable means that policies to the left of where we are currently are not optional. You have to embrace them, right? So for example, if we're not going to grow endlessly, then we're not going to be able to maintain things like full employment. So what do? You reduce working hours. So there was a report recently, I think it was by the New Economics Foundation, I might be wrong about that, that suggested a 21-hour working week. Very radical, but look, it would be popular. Yeah. If we could reach a point in our politics where you were saying, actually, we want to maintain full employment, but full employment means that you're going to have to work less because we've got less work to go around, then policies like what was in the Labour Manifesto of a four-day week become not radical policies, but mainstream politics.
Yeah, and sorry, I just want to jump in on that. Just again, you immediately, you just have to ask the question, who does it serve? Who does the status quo serve where everybody is working in ways that are incredibly stressful, you know, so with real like mental health consequences and, as you know, unstable in terms of their working conditions, yeah, long hours, you know, what is this whole thing is essentially just to enrich a very small group of people. Like that's what it's for. And when you realize that, the idea that the alternative is this really radical, you know, frightening thing just becomes a bit absurd.
We need to stop using the word radical, don't we?
Yeah, if you were reorientating the economy in a way, in your priority was, let's ensure that people can live their best lives, you'd never create the economy that we have now.
Yeah.
So it's just sort of, then immediately you have to think, well, okay, well, then radical solutions are in fact just the natural way that things should go.
Yeah, I mean, there are just all manner of reasons why we need to change things. I mean, I always focus, obviously, because I'm a socialist, on distributional questions. We're living in an era where inequality is almost as bad, I think I'm right in saying, almost as bad, not quite as bad as the Victorian era. In other words, the height of the Industrial Revolution, when things were so unequal in Britain that people would pay money, if they couldn't find a bed to sleep in, to hang from a rope. You know, that's the sort of inequality that we're returning to as a society. And so, you know, we've got to do something about that, obviously. And that means, you know, redistributing wealth I think in an unproblematic way, but that's because it's not my money I'm going after. But if you consider, there was a report I read, it was maybe about 5 years ago now, and it basically said that if you have a, I might have said this before on the podcast, if you have a Norman surname,
oh yeah,
you're more likely to be rich than if you've got an Anglo-Saxon surname because of the Norman conquest. A lot of this money and wealth and privilege goes back as far as 1066, because it was...
Well, I know, you know, as a Northerner, James, you feel particularly strongly about this, obviously, with the harrying of the North of 1070 and the resulting dire consequences. I think, I mean, look, from an historical perspective, you know, that's certainly an interesting finding, but I think it's also... You know, you don't have to go back that far. You know, it is definitely just baked into, you know, certainly the evolution of capitalism in Britain in the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries and 19th centuries. You know, you have a landed elite. There's this myth, isn't there, that the landed elite was sort of like really snooty about capitalism and they kind of kept their distance from it. They didn't invest. This is just complete nonsense. Like, the landed elite absolutely bought into all of these new economic ventures. They were central to their success because they provided the capital necessary to get these really quite risky overseas operations off the ground, and they therefore profited massively from them. And that's, you know, that's essentially the bedrock
and
of
from
the
imperialism, you know, of course.
Absolutely, of course. Yeah. So the people who created this wealth were factory workers in Manchester working in the most unimaginably exploitative conditions, and then the people of the Britain colonized with all the dire human consequences. And of course, imperialism was all about that growth, right? You had to keep going on and expanding the markets that were open to the British Empire in order to try and keep that economic growth going. And of course, you know, eventually that becomes unsustainable.
And that sort of brings us back to what we were talking about right at the beginning, and might be an opportunity to round things off, that the left have always been anti-imperialists. And we've always been anti-imperialists because, well, for a variety of reasons, but if you follow the work of Rosa Luxemburg, she argued that capitalism could only survive through imperialism, because capital needs to search out new markets for its goods. Because the issue, using the sort of Marxist ideas, is that if you're going to put downward pressure on wages, in other words, if capitalism is going to produce inequality, the market for your goods domestically stops existing. You've got a crisis of overproduction. The solution for Luxembourg to that is to expand into new markets, which is where imperialism comes from. And so, you know, the left have always been anti-imperialists, and therefore the left have always been internationalists. There's always been a, you know, and I think it's really important that socialists understand this, that we're not just about making this country better. We're about examining power, how it operates globally, and opposing unequal power and the consequences that unequal power has. And that's going to mean that we're going to have to accept that we can't continue to live like we are. If every country in the world behaved and operated as we do in the West, we'd need about seven Earths to sustain us. It's unsustainable. We are heading towards catastrophe.
Yeah,
you know, it's
agreed.
It's not going to get better.
I mean,
should we leave it there? You're not going to let me wrap up, are you?
Well, you always wrap up before I don't get to say my little bit. You've plugged your socialist. I want to plug a socialist. So, given what you've just said, it brings me back to the idea of utopian socialism. So I talked about the Paris Commune. Utopian socialism isn't this like self-indulgent sort of like, oh, let's just pretend the world. It's actually absolutely vital. In a situation where the world is just heading for catastrophe and the status quo is leading you there, you absolutely have to think in utopian terms. You have to think in terms of just, let's imagine we could radically reinvent this. Let's imagine that a totally different kind of world is possible. You know, this, you know, another world is possible. You know, I think that was the Momentum slogan, wasn't it? It was used in one of their conferences, right? Or World Transformed, I guess.
No idea.
So anyway, the thing I would flag up would be William Morris, who gives us the title of this podcast, and who is absolutely, you know, a writer who totally reimagines what the kind of like really grim conditions of urban Victorian Britain could look like in a transformed society. And that, you know, it's really worth reading his book News from Nowhere, which kind of sets out this vision, and it's something that I found really, really inspiring to engage with. And you know, in terms of like our name, this title of this podcast, Under Another Name, it encapsulates the idea that we're fighting a battle that has been fought for generations, exactly as you've described, James, but we're having to fight it in a unique context, and so we're fighting for a different set of specific goals, but the broad principles are absolutely the same, and people are going to come after us. And so we're also, you know, as socialists, we're people who are also helping to prepare the ground for people who are going to continue to fight these battles later on, because they're worth fighting.
Under Another Name.
Exactly right. Thanks for listening.
If you've liked this podcast, don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll see you hopefully next week, if we can schedule it for next week. Bye-bye.